Schweizer Amerika. Views from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler. Grüezi miteinander and welcome to another episode of Views from the Sister Republic. Today, live from the St. Gallen Symposium. Well, for you, it's not going to be live, but we are live at the symposium with one man who has taken the stage twice today, and that is Jason Thielmann. Welcome to the podcast, Jason.
Thank you so much for an opportunity to join you today.
Jason Thielmann has spent a large portion of his professional career in politics, but behind the scenes most of the times, or practically all of the times, although there have been a lot of press clippings last year about your work that you were doing. You worked for Montana Senator Steve Daines as chief of staff. You had helped him get elected first into Congress and then into the Senate. And then you were asked to help him work towards a senatorial majority, which you achieved with 4 net gains. And now you are putting all that knowledge that you gained in the Senate machinery, in the campaigning machinery, into strategic consultancy with S2R Public Affairs. How did you get into politics in the first place, Jason? Because you have a background not unlike most people who study here, that you did a business bachelor's and that you worked mainly in marketing. What made you go into politics?
Well, I don't recall ever being more interested in anything else than I was in politics. From my, you know, youngest of days, I remember when Ronald Reagan was sworn in when I was 4 years old. And I just always had a love and interest in passion in politics and public policy.
But why then not study political science?
The way I saw politics is that political results are achieved fundamentally through marketing and business. So I thought it was better to have an understanding of marketing and finance if you wanted to both be successful in running for office or understanding how to win office and run marketing campaigns. And then if you wanted to be successful at governing, it was far more useful to have an understanding of finance and accounting and business.
And how did you get into your first campaign?
So my freshman teacher in high school in Montana, we have what we call a citizen legislature. So most of the people who serve in the small states, state legislature, do something else for a living. And every 2 years, they come together for a 90-day period to pass the state's budget and evaluate various laws and so forth. So his day job was being a high school government teacher and debate coach. Actually, he was also my debate coach for that in high school. And his terms were 4-year terms. So as I was a freshman, he was coming up for election. And he knew I had a passion and loved politics, so he offered to pay me to go drop literature at every door in his state Senate district in rural Montana, which I couldn't have been more excited to do. And I paged for him when he was a state legislator. I did the same thing for him again when I was a senior in high school, when he was up for election again. And later in life, after I graduated from college, he ran for statewide office as the Secretary of State for the state of Montana. And I first volunteered for his campaign, painting highway signs that we would put up for name recognition. So I painted a 1,500 4x8 highway signs out of an old abandoned barn. They were red. My teeth turned red. I went through multiple pairs of tennis shoes that turned red. I had to grow all my fingernails out because I had red underneath them for 2 months. But by the end of the campaign, you know, it's a low profile race, so you don't really hire professional staff. And 20 years ago, it was even less of a professional industry. I found myself managing his campaign in the final months. And when he was elected, I had graduated from college at that point in time and was working in banking and marketing. He asked me if I'd go be his chief of staff. And I said, yes. 24 years old, 2 years out of college, and I was excited to do it and wasn't what I was expecting. I didn't help him because I wanted a job. I helped him because he was my beloved history teacher and I believed in him and I was just excited to help.
You mentioned one interesting position that we don't really know in, I think, the entirety of Europe. Probably you said you paged for him. Can you explain what that means?
So in the legislature, they'll often have interns, really. So they're just people who answer the phones and deliver messages. Back then, you know, people didn't have cell phones particularly. So you sat in a room and constituents would call and you'd write down a note and you would hand it to the senator, and there'd also be a hall where all the lobbyists and others were at. Legislature, no, none of those people could get into the floor of the legislature. But your job would be to go page elected official and say somebody wanted to talk to you. So you'd sit in the lobby hall and they'd grab you and you'd go page them. So hence the term page.
How much does a page earn?
It was whatever minimum wage was at the time. And he had to move to the state, move to the state capital. And he found, found a nice elderly couple that put me up in their basement for a couple months and couldn't have been more excited to do it.
That's a very hands-on trajectory. I mean, painting signs.
It was not glamorous, right?
Yeah, but it sounds like something very physical also.
There was a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
You had to silk screen them and paint them. And I mean, it was dirty hard work.
And how did you make the transition then from helping someone in state politics to a race for a national office?
So that really gave me a platform. Even though it was a lower tier, I was still chief of staff to, I had staff of 50 and a budget and had to appear before the state legislature. And he ran for governor at the end of that term, which is a more high profile, serious race. He wasn't successful, but the people that we brought in to do television and polling were involved in races nationally. Mm-hmm. So after the race, even though it wasn't successful, I actually went back into banking and finance, but I had a relationship with them. And later on, when I was living in a different state, working, like I said, in banking and finance, they needed someone to manage a congressional race. And they're like, that kid didn't seem like he fell out of a turnip truck. We can't find anybody else. Maybe, we hear he's down in Colorado. Maybe he'd be open to going and doing this. And that was where I got started on the federal national level.
And how different was that then? How much more professional, how much more glamorous was it perhaps in comparison what you had experienced beforehand?
Well, it was more glamorous than painting signs. At that point in time, I realized you could buy them. Instead of having to paint them. So I suppose that part was more glamorous. And it was more money, and it was a sitting member of Congress. So you had a larger staff, a more established organization. So it was certainly a more professional, but it wasn't remarkably different. Now I had the value of not wanting to get the education from a second kick of a mule, right? So I knew a lot more than I did. I had no business running the governor's race that I ran when I ran Bob Brown, who was his name, when I was his chief of staff and ran his governor's race unsuccessfully when I was quite young. I had no business running that race. I really didn't know what I was doing based on my prior experience. But having done the other, I was, a much savvier operator, still very green and inexperienced, but much better perspective of what works.
How big was the electoral district that we're looking at here for this race?
So geographically, it was pretty big. I think it was the 13th largest congressional district in America. So it stretched the borders of the north-south borders of Colorado, encompassed about 650,000-700,000 voters with kind of a wide range of issue sets from rural to more suburban areas of Denver that were part of it. So it was, it was not quite as big as the state of Montana by population or geography, but similar and a little higher profile because it was a race that was going to, in 2008, be an important race in determining who would have control of Congress right as you were going through TARP and the financial collapse in 2008.
And so the next race that you would manage would then be for who is now Senator Daines, also for Congress first. Mm-hmm. What does it entail to, quote unquote, run a race? I mean, what did your job really entail in the day-to-day business?
So, much of it is fundraising. Mm. Right? So overseeing a fundraising operation is a huge aspect of what you need to do in those roles. Managing and helping the candidate, especially in the instance of that race, right? He was, really a first-time candidate. So you had to help train and go through issue sets. You had to work with a team of consultants from someone who was polling and helping you navigate and understand how the electorate would understand the issues and what were the right issues to emphasize and what were the right messages. You would, you worked and managed marketing a TV vendor. You had a direct mail vendor. You had a fundraising mail vendor. So you had a team of consultants, and then you had a team of people that worked directly for the campaign. So a lot of it really the best way I think of what does it mean to run a campaign like that. If somebody asked you to open up a small gas station and they said, you got to go raise the money. You've got to make all of your profit to recoup your investment. But that gas station is really going to be only open for one day. So you're going to spend the next year or 2 years putting everything together to make sure you have the gas station that wins the majority of the market, plurality of the market share in town on this given day. So that's really what it is. It's a startup business is what it is.
To what extent did you get involved into policy actually?
Well, a lot of people love the idea of volunteering and getting involved in campaigns because they want to write these thoughtful policy papers. And candidly, campaigns are, don't involve a lot of in-depth policy conversations. They're more about larger trends and larger overarching messaging that typically doesn't get down into as much detail. As they say, the devil is in the details, right? So once you start breaking down into real specific polity remedies, there's, the nature of it is these problems are complex. So you're really actually, this doesn't sound too great, but you're trying to avoid actually talking too much about detailed policy.
The time that Senator Daines spent as a congressman was relatively short until he then already got into the race for the Senate. How different is a Senate race from a Congress race?
It's a massive difference.
In what ways?
So, these data points are probably somewhat dated, but the difference between an average House race in America is probably $4 million, $5 million for a competitive House race, maybe $8 million. A competitive Senate race is a $200 million, $300 million effort.
In all states?
For a competitive one.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Right? Just a massive degree of scale of difference. So that's the most simple way to give you a measurement, but it goes so much beyond that. The level of attention from press, from media, the expectations involved, the scrutiny that's involved is, exponentially different. A lot of people have a difficult time who ran a race for Congress, for example. They might then run for the Senate. They oftentimes are surprised at how different the expectations and the scrutiny is in the race for Senate compared to what they viewed as a competitive or very similar exercise in running for a congressional office.
To what extent does the National Party get involved, if at all?
It varies, right? So, the National Party shouldn't be considered to be a monolithic entity with one mothership or one mind.
Right? That's a very big difference, actually, from most European parties.
Yes, yeah.
Not that they are monolithic, but they tend to be more on the monolithic side than in the U.S.
So in the U.S., the party and races operate, more sort of under a franchise model with a lot of decentralized control and much less centralized control. And I think that's even more true with the Republican Party than it is the Democrat Party, although certainly probably in comparison to Europe, much different in that regard. So the National Party tends to be most important as it relates to drawing significant resources into the race, either by the party directly or its ability to convene and credential candidates in races with the most significant donors. But it varies, right? When Senator Daines was chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee and I was executive director, the National Party apparatus for Republican Senate races took a very aggressive, a non-traditionally aggressive stance in the involvement in each one of these races and candidates.
What does that mean? Aggressive involvement in that case.
So we're more aggressive in recruiting and identifying candidates, and we're more aggressive in discouraging candidates that we did not think would have the best opportunity for success. So in 2022, and you also in prior election cycles, Republicans felt that they should have either kept the Senate or retaken the Senate. But the reason they didn't was that they ended up with candidates coming out of very bruising inter-party battles. So either some would say the wrong candidate came out of it, or if it was the right candidate, they came out too damaged and broke from that effort to be successful in the general election. So our mandate, mission, and business plan was to take a different approach in the 2024 cycle of more aggressively managing that process. So in 2022, Republicans in Senate races, just in Senate races, spent $315 million attacking one another in their primaries. In 2024, the number, while still significant, was dramatically less. It was $67
million. So
Democrats
That's a fraction. I mean, it's still humongous.
From European elections. And for the first time in really anything anyone can find, Republicans spent less money on their primary fights determining their party's nominee in these Senate races than Democrats. Democrats actually spent $120 million in 2024.
How competitive were the races for Senator Daines that you were part of? We all have an image of Montana in our minds. I think it was now greatly shaped by the TV show Yellowstone, where you imagine a rather rugged landscape with a people that is also a bit more rugged, but hearty. So how hard can it be to win there as a Republican?
So two facts there. First is, there have only been three Republicans ever. Remember, each state in the United States has two U.S. senators. Since Montana's statehood in 1889, there have only been three Republicans ever elected to the United States Senate, and only two of them, including Senator Daines, that were reelected.
Why was it such a blue state?
So much of populists used to be Democrats once upon a time, and Montana was a populist libertarian state. The farmers and the mining interests and the unions, were more traditionally Democrat constituencies. So Montana, on the local level was Democrat. When Steve was reelected to the Senate in 2020, he was running against a Democrat governor in the state who was one of the most popular governors in America. And it was at that point in time, the most expensive race on a per vote basis in U.S. history.
Oh, wow.
His re-election was very competitive. His initial race in 2014 was less competitive because we had a retirement of a 36-year Democrat Senator Max Baucus that left a void that we were well timed for. But the re-election was second or third most competitive race in the 2020 cycle and the most expensive on a per vote basis in 2020.
Once elected, it's time to legislate. And you were part of that team as well. Your last position was as chief of staff. What does that mean to work behind the scenes in the Senate? What were your jobs? How big is the team of a senator? Who is working on the team of a senator? Take us behind the scenes.
So the average senator has a staff of 40 to 50 people.
40 to 50.
Yeah, that's their, some of those.
A lot of parliamentarians in Europe being extremely jealous.
Well, you got to manage them, so maybe they should be less jealous. But I'm sure that does seem like a luxury. So half of those are, roughly, and each senator might choose to organize their office differently. Half of them are back in the state, providing services and being accessible to the constituency. And the other half are back in the DC office. Some of them are support staff. Most are legislative or communication staff. So the people whose job it is to be the in-depth policy experts, helping draft legislation, helping interpret legislation, helping prepare the senator for hearings and for meetings and putting together the coalitions to help them successfully implement legislation. The job of the chief of staff is to oversee that process. Most people, the chief is different senators give different levels of authority and trust to their chiefs of staff. Senator Daines and I went back from the very beginning, so I have enjoyed a great deal of trust and confidence that I could execute what he wanted done. So I did most of the hiring, the managing of staff, reviewed most comments that would go out under his name, most releases, speeches, do the initial evaluation of how he would likely fall down on any piece of legislation. So there's a lot of managing of external constituencies in that. Part of that is ultimately feeds into your reelection, but it's also just dealing with a lot of the key people, both in the state and nationally, who are looking to achieve something through the center and understanding how to balance, understanding what pieces of information need to flow to him and what decisions he needs to be part of and what decisions you and the staff can manage so you can help him keep focused on his larger objectives.
So you're kind of gatekeeper also.
Yeah, huge part of it is certainly being gatekeeper, right? So a chief of staff has got a job of managing down, but then they also have a huge job of managing up.
And to what extent do you now get more involved in policy? Now as chief of staff, do you get, you've already said that you're looking essentially at all speeches that he's giving, looking at all communications from the office, et cetera. So to what extent does that have a policy component?
Well, I mean, you're also involved in looking at every piece of legislation he might be sponsoring, looking at what questions and objectives he's going to be pushing an individual hearing. So it's a pretty massive job. Now, fortunately, I would say one of my greatest strengths that was, you know, really instilled in me by the center, somebody who came from the private sector, is, you know, he trained me to be really good at hiring a team and building a team. So in my final years as a chief of staff, I did a lot less of those things because we had a loyal staff, a well-trained staff that, had the judgment and the tact and the wisdom to really do most of those things with, you know, nominal oversight and review by someone like me or the senator.
What amount of time would you spend in the home state and what amount of time in DC?
So most of my time was in DC, but I'd get back to the home state, you know, probably close to every month. And then when we were in election cycle, I would really move back to the state for a period, you know, usually 6 months or 8 months preceding the election.
That's a long time.
Ask my wife.
You've also mentioned that you would anyway maintain an office back in Montana during the entire time. Have, I think you said, 20 staff members back there who would, as you phrased it, provide services to the constituents. Now, we are in a system where in very few countries, parliamentarians would have an office that would be accessible to constituents, etc. So what kind of services would you provide? Is it just information that you would have an open ear to people's worries? What are we talking about?
It's all those things and more. So they'd, you know, usually have multiple offices spread across the state with an effort to make sure you're as accessible to constituents as possible. So, you know, one of the, you know, it's not the what people necessarily perceive as the sexiest part of job, but often is one of the most rewarding and meaningful parts of the job. People oftentimes, this might be a surprise, but find government not responsive to their problems or concerns or issues. So it might be a veteran who earned a medal that was never presented or given to them for their service, maybe decades ago, and it got caught in the military bureaucracy. It might be a veteran who is eligible for disability payments or a spouse of a deceased veteran, and for some reason the bureaucracy is not managing the paperwork correctly. So it might be somebody trying to get a passport out of a country, or, you know, I once negotiated the release of a U.S. citizen who is deaf and who got stuck in a rural Chinese prison.
Oh, my.
So there are things like that. Also, you know, once had a parent whose son died in China and they couldn't get the body out.
Oh, God.
So there are a range of these issues, but oftentimes it's someone having a challenge with government, sometimes a foreign government, usually the U.S. government, and the bureaucracy simply is not being responsive to providing the services that they're supposed to. So they'll go to their senator, and their senator will shake up the bureaucracy and make sure that they're taken care of and given the services that they're entitled to as a citizen. So that's a huge part of it. A lot of it, too, is going out. The senator, you know, people want the senator to hear from the senator. They want to get updates on what's going on in government, how legislative policies are going to impact them. So since the senator can't cover all of these events and functions, staff will go and give remarks and answer questions on their behalf and then take their concerns back to DC saying, I visited with, you know, this particular company or this particular individual, and they have these concerns over this potential tax policy that you may not have appreciated or realized would impact them in this way. So we want to make sure you understand that.
Okay, really interesting. That's different from the job profile of our parliamentarians, but they also do not have 50 people in their staff. When you're in DC, to what extent does the staff of a Republican senator at all interact with the other side? To what extent would you exchange viewpoints, discuss matters with staff of Democratic senators?
A great deal. So the nature of the checks and balances system in the government of the United States, this wasn't in the Constitution, but it's how the Senate developed, and it's certainly in the spirit of what the founding fathers in the United States have in mind with the Senate, of the Senate being the body that would react more thoughtfully, show more discernment and process in making decisions and passing policy, is unless you have a supermajority, you can't, with the exception of a few pieces of what you would refer to as privileged legislation, the tax cuts would fall under this description, you can't do so without 60 votes out of the 100. So most legislation, if you're going to be successful, there's been very few times in history that one Republicans have never had 60 votes in the U.S. Senate, and Democrats have only had it on it's filibuster, right? So it's enough votes to overcome the filibuster so you could advance to a vote of legislation, not to get too drawn out in process. But Democrats have had sufficient votes not to need Republicans to pass legislation, including appropriations, only three times in history, once during FDR, once during LBJ, and the other time during Obama. So this, of course, is when Social Security was passed, is when LBJ's Great Society and Medicare and Medicaid were created, in Obama, when Obamacare, the quasi-nationalization of U.S. healthcare. So when you've had these massive partisan policy outcomes, have only, you know, rarely can occur and under our system, because to get anything through the U.S. Senate, typically speaking, you have to have a Republican and Democrat. So a very long way of answering your question. If you want to successfully pass legislation, the first thing you do is you call a Democrat Senate office and you start negotiating and figuring out, how do we work together to come to a compromise of introducing legislation that would then have a realistic chance of becoming law? Now, that's not true in the House. If you're a congressman, in the U.S. House of Representatives, you're going to have, unless you're in the minority party, you're rarely going to have much purpose or need of interacting or working with somebody on the other party. On the Senate side, you can't pass most pieces of legislation unless you are talking and actively engaging with somebody of the opposite party.
So you would say those who say that there is so much gridlock and very little conversations across the aisle are just not seeing what is actually happening.
Well, I would say there's a lot of gridlock. I think that's accurate. Part of that, frankly, is, you know, what our founding fathers say, is that a feature or a bug
in the United States,
right? It's intended to make it difficult to pass and build consensus around legislature. Although I think probably by most standards, that's more so, you know, more true today than it has been through most of, probably the most of the last century in American politics. But there's, you know, a great deal of conversation that goes on, but it's increasingly difficult to build sufficient consensus that you can win enough votes from the other side to pass something. Although it happens, you know, virtually probably every week, oftentimes on smaller, less sexy, interesting issues. But, you know, the first piece of legislation that passed, I think it was in the first two weeks, was actually a piece of immigration policy, the Lincoln-Riley Act. Targeting illegal immigrants, creating violent crimes, that passed with more than seven. It took at least seven Democrats. I think 10 Democrats, maybe 15 Democrats, crossed over to join Republicans in passing that piece of legislation, which was bipartisan.
So I said initially that you are in part responsible for the massive gain. Well, I would say they were a lot more substantial than we expected in the last senatorial races in November. You had 4 net gains. And when you joined us at the symposium a year ago, you were still saying that, well, you need at least one to be fine as long as you win the presidency. So you went beyond that. Had campaigning changed substantially since your first race? Until you were really overlooking all senatorial races of the Republicans.
let's say dramatically, right? So someone who might want to, you know, loves running, which I do. I love running political campaigns. When I first started, you know, it would be, there certainly were some, but it would be difficult to make a living running campaigns and doing that as your primary work. They've become so much larger, so much more expensive, so much more sophisticated operations that, you know, the industry, I suppose, of political campaigns and political work, you know, has expanded dramatically from those early years.
To what extent were you collaborating with the presidential campaign?
Almost daily. So, you know, the single most important aspect of having a successful outcome in our Senate races was our ability to coordinate and collaborate with the president and his campaign team. So it was necessary in solving the primary issue that I referenced earlier. The reason we were so successful in not, you know, spending an additional $250 million in Senate primaries in 2024 as we did in 2022 was largely because we had a great collaboration with the president and his team in helping identify who would be the candidates that we could build consensus in the party around. The most important person of whom to begin building consensus with being the president. And that, you know, that more than any other factor was responsible for our ability to be successful. And that, you know, again, it was just very important that we had a great working relationship with the president to solve those problems.
Political scientists claim, and in the data also observe, that there has been a great degree of nationalization of American politics, so that in a lot of states, you could essentially run on the same issues, that there aren't that many local, regional issues that are driving voters, et cetera. Is that also something you've observed, or do you still see that that it means something else to run as a senator in Montana versus running in Idaho or Florida?
There certainly is differentiation that occurs more and further, right? While the race and the issues are certainly very, very nationalized, the quality of the candidate matters because, you know, you're always going to have the candidate for president under almost every circumstance is going to receive more votes than your candidate for Senate office or congressional office on that same ballot. Much of that is people just, they care about who's president, they care less about the other, so they simply, it's, you know, what we call an undervote, they simply don't vote on it. But you still have sufficient crossover vote that you can change the outcome of these elections. In addition, you have third party spoilers, right? So they might vote for the Republican or Democrat candidate for president. They might not like the Senate candidate, so then they'll vote for a Green Party or a Libertarian Party. You know, none of whom will prevail.
Yeah.
But when you're having these elections decided by such narrow margins, 20,000 people. You know, out of 3 million votes can easily change the outcome of one of these lower ballot races.
We've talked about this on the stage, but I'd still like to take this conversation also onto the podcast, namely, what made you win bigger than you expected last year? Because as said, in spring, you were still saying, well, we need at least one win. We were looking at the polling number. A lot of races look tight. The presidential race looked very tight. So to what extent were you in the end just lucky? And to what extent were you just on point with regards to what really mattered to your voters?
Well, I think anyone with any degree of situational and self-awareness has to appreciate at the aftermath of an election, there always is involved an important element of timing. So, you know, certainly to a degree, I would say, you know, my timing was like that bird without a beak, impeccable to be in the situation that we were in. But we made a lot of our own luck as well. Most importantly was making sure that we had these candidates that wouldn't, you know, be so flawed or so broke or damaged that they would, you know, have serious underperformance of how the national ticket was likely to resolve itself in many of these states. So again, that was probably one of the most critical elements. And then from a, you know, zooming out from a more macro picture, what we talked about earlier in the seminar today is there is some, you know, meaningful change and movement and realignment of the political parties in the United States. So still very closely decided elections. I imagine there'll be very closely decided elections for some time to come that will narrowly be decided between one party or the other. But what is very significant is where this realignment is occurring, and the overlay of that alignment, especially in our Senate races and also on the path to 270 electoral votes. So you're seeing working class voters across racial lines voting in higher levels for Republicans than they ever have previously.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, yeah, ever previously. Reagan duplicated something similar to this in his two electoral victories. That would be the closest modern comparison. Now, Democrats are increasing their performance with those in the top 20%. So you almost see an exact flip here. Those earning in the top 20% of income earners and top 20% of educational attainment have become dramatically more Democrat in their voting behavior, whereas those in the bottom 20% have become dramatically more Republican in their voting behavior. What becomes important in that is where these people live. So the Democrats are continuing to do better on the coasts, where you have people more likely to earn more and more likely to have higher educational attainment. And Republicans are now doing better in what we call the Rust Belt states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and increasing their margins also in states like Montana, Ohio, West Virginia, all of whom were states that not too long ago actually were more reliably Democrat states. Both West Virginia and Montana for most of the 21st century, or 20th century rather, were reliably hard blue Democrat states. So you've seen a real change in voters in those groups move, and that really has a change in the electoral landscape of where you're going to win and lose and how you're going to win and lose. So Democrats always call these states the blue wall states. Those are the states that helped them win most presidential elections since 1988, was prevailing those states. They called it their blue wall, and their blue wall
has crumbled. Totally. And a lot of people are looking at the Democratic Party and are doubtful whether it can really rebuild, not a blue wall, but really an electoral success in 4 years. You have managed Republican races and overseen them and brought, as goes the name of your company, strategy to results.
Thank you for saying that again.
Well, I'm not sponsored by you, but maybe we can talk about that later. We still need a business model for this podcast. But if you were to advise the Democratic Party, who do you think would make a good presidential candidate for them? Because everyone asks me, who can they send into the presidential race in 4 years? So who would you put your money on?
I would put my money on the individual that can try to reconnect and re-emphasize their connection with the working class voter. So part of this is a larger branding issue, but when you have a nominee, they're able to really redefine the brand of the party. So I don't know who I would specifically name. I think they have a challenge if you look at some of the obvious front runners. You know, Governor Newsom from California, you know, very wealthy and slick hair and sort of the poster child for kind of the new Democrat party that appeals to the top 20%, but not so much to the bottom 20%.
Well, he's trying to be a bro podcaster now, so maybe that might change things. But if you're looking at other people that might have less of these barriers, like Gretchen Whitmer, would you put your money on someone like that?
You know, I wouldn't, but that's probably closer than Gavin Newsom in that regard. I think a governor, I can't think of somebody they have in the Senate that makes a good representation of an ability to connect with the working class voter. I think probably more likely they're going to find success in one of their governors who've had to you know, rebrand their politics to allow them to be successful in a state.
Maybe we have someone to talk about next year when you're coming again, hopefully.
I hope so. It's such a privilege to come last year and again this year.
So maybe we have more names then on the table, because the problem is really when you're looking at polls, who are people really identifying with the Democratic Party? You have as top names Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders, and you're like, that's not going to make a national majority.
No, I don't think so. And those polls right now, they're just, those are the names they've heard. They're kind of they're really meaningless noise at this stage of the game.
Thank you so much, Jason, for taking us behind the scenes of successful campaigns, as well as behind the scenes of dissent.
I could do so with unsuccessful ones too. I'm glad you didn't go into that.
That might be the next edition, How to Lose.
I lost before I won, yeah.
Now, to conclude, I'm often asked by people, what should we listen, watch, or read to get a better understanding of American politics? Now, you are someone who has done politics as a living. What are your go-to sources?
So I think it's important to have as many diverse sources as possible. So I think in understanding the current party in power, publications, you know, like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times are going to ill-equip you for giving a good perspective of American politics or how domestic politics are perceived within the United States. Although, you know, I read all three, you know, usually read all three of those newspapers every day. But additionally, I think it's really important actually to monitor and look at some of the social media personalities who are popular with both constituencies on the right and the left, to get sort of an unfiltered perspective of what they have to say. You know, obviously Fox News is still the most dominant source of news within the United States, although less so than it used to be. But I, you know, the business of news now, For better or worse, has been partially democratized, which I would say is for better and less filtered, less editorial control or judgment. But the other piece of that is that everyone now is playing for an audience. So that doesn't help you with sponsorships, because you know you're just trying to provide content.
No, and that was more in jest.
Thoughtful, right?
Yeah. Our government wouldn't appreciate that kind of shenanigan. But you said social media personality. So, who are your favorite podcasters?
You know, Joe Rogan. I don't know if these are my favorite or not, but these are people that I think are, you know, offer important voices to listen to have a better understanding of American politics. But people like Joe Rogan, his podcast, you know, Alex Bruchowitz, who's, you know, credited with having, you know, really aligned the presidential campaign around doing more podcasts and engaging and turning the youth vote to a Republican vote in the most recent election. People like that, I think, are important to get, you know, a voice and a perspective. Now, I'm not suggesting these people are unbiased. Of course, they're biased. I think the reality is now is everyone's biased. So what you need to do is listen to as many biased people as you can from across the various spectrum, so you can find you can make your own judgment and determination over which arguments make sense.
That's a fantastic note to close on. Thank you so much, Jason, for your insights, and I hope to have you back here again.
Me too.
Would be great. And thank you to all our listeners. We hope to have you back again as well. And with that, I wish you auf Wiedersehen.
Fritzi Amerika. News from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler.